This is session 265. We ask that all here today engage thoughtfully and respectfully, understanding that we all come from varying backgrounds and beliefs. Please be respectful in your comments and questions. I think that goes without saying. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, seven issues for the price of six. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. About this session, for some Mormons, losing faith creates an existential crisis, making them ask what life's meaning is. Why is meaning in life so important? What meanings are worth living for? This presentation explores theories and research on meaning and shares insights toward achieving a meaningful life. Gary Horlocker and Ernest Horstmanschaff both received their degrees from BYU. They enjoy studying philosophy and discovering and creating meaning in their post-Mormon life. And I'm so happy to open for you guys.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we're excited to be here. It's been my personal observation that the population of transitioning and transitioned Mormons currently, I think, is exploding. And in fact, I'm stunned by the close transition friends that we've encountered at Sunstone, and it's only been 2 years. So anyway, I hope this is a salient topic. And I hope that what we share today, that we do it with enough clarity that hopefully every one of us can walk away with something that is worthwhile to take away. Now, by way of introduction, I'm going to take a moment and give you some background about us and how we got here. How's that for Mormon background? We both served missions. I served in upstate New York. I used to say my mission is the greatest guest where God visited. Anyway, we were devout LDS to our mid-30s. Church-influenced education. Gary did his PhD there. I'm actually a little embarrassed, but all of my education, Rick's, the BYU, and BYU Law School. So with that background, you ask, well, what happened? Well, we had some challenges to our beliefs. This started ours. We were devout Mormons, but we both, individually, before we knew each other, were dealing with the fact that we were gay. And as a matter of fact, they did two documentaries about 15 years ago, and Bill Bradshaw actually introduced my family on a documentary. And as you can see there, Gary's was understanding LDS homosexuality, go forward. He was going to BYU at the time, PhD. And mine's was on my family because my family was very accepting. I have five brothers, five sisters, two gay brothers, and a lesbian sister. So, and I don't know if these documentaries are still available, but John DeLynn told us, this was one of the very first things I posted about 15 years ago when I was starting to do Mormon stories. So anyway, academically inclined, Gary tried to make sense of this. And so he actually did a study. They did a survey, 2002-2007, surveying highly religious Mormons who were gay. This is what he came up with. Now, if you look at the top, there were actually individuals who wrote in their survey, I am attracted to men, but I am not gay. The strugglers, we call them. And then there were the reconcilers. These were people who accepted their homosexuality but wanted to be accepted by the church. And so you see we have this graph, and at the bottom is just where coincidentally Gary and I both ended up in searching. We moved on and we are now from a secular position. So anyway, I know that there are different things that break people's shelves. I want to tell you what broke mine. On Mormonism, it was the Mormon murders. I am a contemporary of Mark Hoffman. And ironically, it wasn't an overriding dogma that shook me, but it was the fact that I was convinced after reading this nonfiction work by two journalists from the New York Times that the highest leaders of the church were being deceitful and not telling the truth. The worst part of it for me was actually more of a personal feeling. There was an individual who had received a special calling, special blessing to help obtain these papers. And when the story hit the newspapers, they abandoned him. And for some reason, that did it for me. That was the final step. However, it went further. And I'm not missionizing. I'm telling you about my journey. After reading The God Delusion, I suffered what I call probably the hardest existential experience, the death of belief. Not only in God, but what was harder for me, the death of belief in an afterlife. So, but what do you do when that happens? What now? I'm 50 years old. Who am I? What's my purpose in life? What is truth? No longer having the answers. And realize I'm at a new journey. I've got to find new answers, and I've got to find new questions. So what happened is, I happened to join a philosophy group, and in almost a 8-year period, we covered a variety of topics. And there were two big words that popped up that I thought, oh my, what does that mean? And as we studied philosophy, the first is epistemology. And epistemology is the question of how do you know something is true? How do we know? And I suspect that maybe the majority of people in this room that have transitioned have at once time said with absolute certainty, I know. So epistemology challenges how do we know? The other word is ontology. Ontology asks, what is existence? What is reality? How do you experience life? And one thing I finally realized was that your epistemology, what you know to be true and what you believe to be true, affects your experience in life, your ontology. So with that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to the scholar.
Wow. I'm going to give you the heavy stuff, and then Ernie gets to come in afterwards and tell you how it works in our life. So he gets the fun stuff again. So hopefully this is not going to be too much for somebody. I'm sure everybody's background is different here. I was going to get a handout with a bibliography of all the books and articles I've studied for this presentation, and I didn't get it done, but I brought some of the books, so if I mention an author or you're curious, you can come up and look at these books. So here's a little outline of what I'm going to say. The first part of it's abstract, and there's theoretical parts. What is the meaning of life? So what is the question? What are some of the answers philosophy and psychology have found? The second part is more personal. What meanings make life worth living? And the big part of this, and I hope your take-home message, is moving from a beyond life to a within life meaning, meaning that we're not going to look for meaning outside of our life. We're going to look for meaning within our lives. And there's four themes that have been pointed out, and I'm going to go into depth on each one of those four, and then I'm going to give you the answer to the holy question, what is the meaning of life? Everybody's always wanted to know, so I'll tell you today. Philosophy and psychology are the two most pertinent areas of science for this. Philosophy talks about what are we asking? What's the question? What does that mean? And so we start defining what we're talking about with philosophy, narrowing it down to a specific question rather than leaving it vague and meaning four or five different things. Psychology has to take those definitions now and create surveys and say, well, what captures that essence and how can we test it reliably and with validity? So they create the variables, they create the experiments to test this. And we have a lot of data from both of these fields on the topic today. So here's a little preface. I would like to get into this more, but this is a whole different topic, and so I'm just going to kind of give you a little overview, and don't worry if you don't get it all. But we talk about the self. What is the self? You can see that's going to be a big question, but yet it's also important for knowing meaning who the self is. And so I like to think of marriage. What is marriage? Is marriage real? It's not real like this table, is it? It's not material. It doesn't have substance. It's not that kind of real. But it does a function in our society, and people know what it means, and they react to it. We have laws that respect it and give it certain status. So it's real on the one hand, and it's not real on the other hand, right? It's both. Real and not real. That's kind of the way the self is. The self is real and it's not real. It's functional. It serves a purpose. It's the center of my story and everything I've done. But is there a self in the middle? So we have, it's not on that slide, but it must be the next one. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, for this slide, I'm just going to say that we need to see ourselves from the point of view external to ourselves. So we have a human need to feel validity for who we are, because we really are not anything. I mean, I know some people believe in the spirit and that has substance, but I'm talking as a secular atheist. They don't believe that we have anything. So if that's the case, then you can see why we have a need for others in our life to give us validity that we're okay, and from our projects, outside sources, besides people who love us, the things I'm working on validate who I am. And I would like to talk about Heidegger and Frankfurt more, but who we are is a lot of times reflected on what we care about, what we love. This is the center of what all of our engagements are about, is what we care about. Our love, our stories about that's another aspect. And so the last thing I wanted to say is about consciousness. We talk about inorganic material, and we talk about organic, and you go up the life chain, and you get to humans, and humans are a little different animal than other animals. And what makes us different? Well, we have language. And language is made up of metaphors, and metaphors are unique because I can talk about a river and it can change how I think about something completely different, like what I had for lunch today or something. Because if I apply this to this, I've got a whole bunch of new metaphors to think about. So when we gained the ability to language, we also eventually gained the ability to use metaphors to expand our consciousness, to go beyond what animals are not able to do. And the other area, when we still get in this plot where even our metaphors don't work for us, we have transcendent experiences. It's awe. We sit back and we go, whoa, that just blew my mind. I can't deal with that. I'm just going to enjoy the experience. So there are things we don't have metaphors for, and transcendent experiences we're going to talk about as we go on. So I wanted to give that as a preface. The work by Susan Wolf, is trying to create a place for the middle column there. So we talk about ideals for living, and the happy life and the meaningful life or the moral life have go back into ancient times, and people have always talked about the meaningful life or the happy life. Epicureans were trying to find the happy life, and Kant is one of the early philosophers, talked about duty and morality and what is the good moral life. And Susan Wolf does a wonderful essay on what is a meaningful life, and she explains how meaning is different. They overlap. These three things are similar, and they overlap, but they also do unique things that the others don't do. So the happy life focuses on happiness. The moral life focuses on morality and duty. Meaningful life focuses on meaning. Happy life is focused on the self. The moral life is focused on others, causes outside of myself. And the meaningful life is self-engaged with other. And so the subjective values are important for a happy life. What do I love? And for a moral life, objective values, do what matters, do what's important. And for the meaningful life, you have to have both. Love doing things that matter, okay? So we're going to combine the two. Anyway, you can see the rest of those. Finding and pursuing one's passion is a happy life. Contributing to something larger is a moral life. Passion for what matters. So we're going to combine these, and I've got some examples of why this is not the same as happiness. Meaning is different because if you were happy, you wouldn't spend all night working on a daughter's dress or visiting loved ones in the hospital that are really annoying and demanding and drag you down. You do it because you have a higher meaning for those things. Moving your neighbor's furniture, research, piano practicing, gardening, these are things that we do because of a higher reason, because they're meaningful, because we love them, not because they're making us happy all the time. And I got some Mormon meanings there on the left that work for the dead, fasting for the sick, serve mission for the church, callings. And on the right are things that show that are not meaningful. So doing a crossword puzzle isn't necessarily helping anybody else. Breaking rocks, they said that was a real flaw when they tried to get prisoners to break rocks just to give them something to do, that they just revolted. They would not do that. That goes against our nature as humans to do something so unmeaningful. And what's one of the interesting findings is that happiness does not correlate with depression. You can be high in happiness and high in depression at the same time. So how does that work? How is it that sometimes wealthy countries are high in suicide and yet we have so many luxuries of life and the poor ones are not? Why is it that Mormons and Scandinavian countries are both highest when you talk about happiness and highest when it comes to depression and suicide rates? So I think the answer is that it's not happiness that's leading to depression, it's meaningfulness, and it shows that these are different things. So a lot of people, I think when this first started back after World War II in France, this movement about meaning, they talked about the absurd, and this is an existential, I think Albert Camus, made it popular. And it's kind of a reaction. They were just like the Mormons today are that first one. What matters in life is meaning. That promotes meaning. And God, afterlife, and the soul are the source of meaning. So you've got a balance there. And as long as you've got these two things in balance, life is going really good. But if you don't believe in God and a soul and an afterlife anymore, then you no longer have a balance. And what happens? You're struggling. You have depression, lack of direction, despair. That's not a healthy place to be in. So also Mormons sometimes see what I call the nihilist straw man, because they believe that the meaning is what life is about, and they can't imagine that someone that doesn't have an objective meaning can have a purpose in life. And so they think, well, this is immoral, suicide, apathy. It makes sense that these people would stop caring about anything once they lose their belief in God. Albert Camus and Thomas Nagel are two academic, or anyway, they're intellectuals. Albert Camus wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus about the gods force this person to push a rock up the top of the hill every day, and it would fall back down, and you'd have to start over the next day, and that was his punishment. So the most meaningless thing you can think of to do, and so the question is, if you don't believe in gods, how is life worth meaning? Is life worth living? Is there a reason not to kill yourself? And Albert Camus said, yes, there is, to rebel against the absurd. And so, you know, it's a brave and proud thing to be able to go against something as huge as meaningfulness and just say, I don't care, I'm going to rebel against the system. Thomas Nagel, more recently, he's still alive, I think, as a philosopher, said, well, I don't really agree with how he set that up. And he said that what he really believes the problem is that we take our lives so seriously. We have to be serious. We need to pay the rent. We need to put food on the table. And so we have to take life serious. And yet, because of our consciousness being able to think outside of ourselves, we can put ourselves into someone else's perspective. And from different angles, the things we think are serious could not be serious at all. And so how do we deal with this fact that we have to be serious and at the same time the things we are serious about may not be important? And so he believed that we need to just accept this contradiction and with irony and resignation and just live the life the best. And I think this was the best attempts that people have been able to do to come to terms with the fact that there isn't an overall meaning in life. An absolute, all-encompassing meaning. I think that there's a better answer, and we're going to talk about that. But first, I drew up this. This is kind of a silly little drawing, and I should have fixed it up, but I didn't have time. So anyway, on the left, you see, it says, how do I get from here to there, here being on the left and there being on the right? And the guy is up at the pinnacle of this mountain, and it says ultimate meaning, eternal life, sacrifice, exaltation, family forevers, calling and election, salvation, resurrection, work for the dead. He's done everything, or she's done everything. And she's unhappy because she's looking down and she sees these two happy people over there, and they're on another ledge, and there's a gulf between these two ledges, and there's no bridge, there's no way to get from one to the other. These are two different frames of two different mindsets. So you don't just go from, there's no ladder between the two. You're either in the left camp or you're in the right camp. And the right people on the right, they say they value time with others, they value good health, learning, helping beautify the world, optimizing relationships. They're holding hands and they have a big smile on their face. So I put a mist of darkness between the two, and I said, without God, there is no purpose or meaning. Without an afterlife, why do anything? Nothing matters. This is the kind of mentality you have if you're in the left camp. So how do I get from here on the left to where these happy people are? That's what we're going to talk about. So just to finish on the definition of meaningfulness, like I said, this Susan Wolf, she says, life is meaningful insofar as it is actively and lovingly engaged in projects of worth. And then this is kind of a cute little phrase. She says, meaning arises when subjective attraction, that's me, what I'm attracted to, meets with objective attractiveness. That's Ernie. In my world. We each have our own world, so this is an individual thing, and we have to figure out what works for us. We need our lives to be valuable from the point of view external to ourselves. We need other people to reflect back to us that we're valuable and loved. And we need validation from engaging in projects, even if we're unaware that we need that validation. That is an important part of being human. So, two books, Emily F. Esfahani Smith and Jonathan Haidt have done kind of, they've watered it down to our level so we can read these books, but they've studied all the literature and psychology and philosophy, and they've come up with four themes that all of this meaningfulness talks about. So these are what we call the pillars of meaning. They are relationships or belonging, purpose or work, adversity and storytelling narratives, sense-making, I call that, and transcendence, a loss of self. So all of the different studies and literature usually fall into one of these categories. So I'm going to tell you about each one of these, and hopefully I'm not losing time. We're all okay so far. The first, relationship and bonding, and this is actually the most important. And I want to say some of us, I'm going to say a little bit later, some of us are thinkers and we don't necessarily have a sensitivity. Autistic people don't always know, don't always value other people's feelings, and they might step on their toes and hurt them. But yet, if you do that to them, it's going to hurt. So we all have this need, not just the people who are sensitive to it. We all have this need. This is not just for those people over there that are feely and sensitive. Sense of belonging is the most important driver of meaning, and benefits from social relations have been shown in psychological studies to provide happier, stronger immune system, recover quicker from surgery, anxiety risk is reduced, depression risk is reduced, and people live longer. All of that. If you look at people in old age who are single versus those who are married, there's a statistical difference. So you're going to have a better chance in the last years of life if you have someone to share it with. Belonging involves two conditions. Mutual care, when others think and treat you like you matter, you believe you matter. So I need someone outside of myself to think I matter. And frequent, pleasant interactions. So that's having lunch, having dinner together every night, or meeting for lunch. That might be going to a movie. It might just be hanging out in the same house. That creates bonding and relationships. So Durkheim, he's a really important sociologist, began at the beginning of sociology. He studied religion and transcendent experiences. And in 1897, he wrote one of the classics. And he said that suicide has two causes. And I think this is important for the post-Mormon people to know, because we're vulnerable here. One, alienation from communities correlates with higher suicide. And two, less social restraints imposed by our communities correlates with higher risk of suicide. So you think, well, I want to break out. It's imposing all these restrictions on me. But ultimately, we kind of thrive with restrictions. I guess mothers know that with their kids, that their kids sometimes do better when you give them rules. And so, you know, we do want to break out of that jar, but how do we avoid this problem? I think with the November policy, thank you. I knew it didn't sound right. Okay. The church basically rejected one segment of the members, and so this is one of the areas that alienation from communities. You feel you don't belong, feeling like life is meaningless. I need an extra word in there. Life is meaningless. And rating their own life as meaningless. These are what happens in studies where they've done studies where they have everybody pick somebody to be on a team, and then they tell half of the people, nobody picked you. And then they see how what they describe what life is like afterwards compared to the ones that say, well, you were picked to be on the team. People wanted you. And so this is the results of psychological studies, and this is where I said the thinkers maybe need to tune in, because search for meaning is not a solitary philosophical quest we create within ourselves for ourselves. Rather, meaning lies largely in others. So even though I think I'm fine at home doing my research and I don't need other people and I'll just sit in my library for the rest of my life and figure out great things, our bodies won't react to that well. We do need others. So the second theme, I'll try to go quicker here, purpose. Purpose has two dimensions. It creates a far-reaching goal that motivates and organizes our lives. We can think about our goal of accomplishing a task, and it creates that feeling of stability for ourselves that are is a construct in my mind. Contributing positively to an external good is the other dimension. So again, we have to have something outside of ourselves. So this is just like belonging, but it's for everything else. This is meaning. This is for things that are not with people. And examples might be on a really large level, eliminating world hunger, eliminate nuclear testing. But for most of us, it's more like being a good parent or creating cheer at work, or maybe a teen cleaning or cooking for his siblings, or an animal lover feeding a giraffe. So these are all meaningful things. And they require self-reflection and self-knowledge. And once you've done that, you've analyzed, you know kind of what makes you tick and who you are and what is important to you, then you've got to go out and do something to benefit someone outside of yourself or some project, some cause. The journey of self-discovery, I'm going to use the word calling because we're going to discover what our calling is in life, is unique and fits individuals. So it's not like I can tell you what your calling is. This is something for you. It's not up to the bishop to determine what your calling is. This is up to you to decide. And a lot of the themes in this area of research deal with work, because most of us spend 70% of our lives in our work. And there's three different ways you can think of your work. You can think of your work as a job, you can think of it as a career, you can think of it as a calling. If it's a job, you do it for money, you watch the clock, you might have outside hobbies for fulfillment. That's going to give you the least amount of meaning. That's really, we try to rethink that if that's where you're at, because that's kind of sad. Career is the next one. People have goals for advancement. It's energizing but also stressful. And you like take your work home to get ahead. You're trying to do things that might cause problems for your family or for other goals. Now, the best one is calling. A calling is intrinsically fulfilling. I'm doing something that is making the world better at the same time. And it's contributing to a greater good. It has a flow. You don't notice the time. Service jobs are the most meaningful of jobs, they found. And that's because they're very easy to think of as a calling. Any worker can find purpose and meaning. So it doesn't matter if you're holding a sign for cars in the hot sun all day. There is a way to think of this as a service, and the most tedious tasks can be made purposeful when they benefit the people you love. So if I think of how this is going to benefit the people I love, it changes how I think about that job. If the sign holder thinks about his coworkers and says, I don't want them to get hurt or hit by a car, and I really would like to help these people in the cars, even if they don't know me, there's ways you can think about things to make them more meaningful. The third theme, sense-making and storytelling. Trauma can shatter a belief system and force people to put the pieces back together, often in a grander and more coherent way. So for ex-Mormons, for people who are no longer fit, it actually can give you a way of creating a better, more cohesive way of making sense of the world. There's something called the adversity hypothesis. They have a hard and a soft version. People need adversity, setbacks, trauma to reach the highest strength, fulfillment, personal development. We can see problems with that. Maybe they won't recover from it. Maybe it'll kill them. But they also have found that there's something called post-traumatic growth. So PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and post-traumatic growth both come out of the same situations. You can find people, and psychology for a long time was studying the negative side of it. And now there's a branch of psychology that's studying post-traumatic growth. Why is it that some people actually have grown and actually doing better? after the same horrific thing that somebody else ruined their life. And so this is a really fascinating area to read. Make what they're doing, the making sense that leads to health. Oh, that's just another finding that that they found that people, they asked people to think about the worst time in their life, the worst situation of their life, and they asked them to write for 10 minutes about it, to try to think about the situation. And those that tried to make sense of their situation and actually made some progress, it was miraculous, and those results were not just temporary, they were long-term results that made their lives meaningful and worthwhile. Benefits of extreme stress. I almost hesitant to even read that because it sounds so awful, but it can reveal hidden abilities. You didn't know you had some ability and you just had to do it now that you were forced to, and that's going to change how we think of ourselves in a positive way because now we have another ability we didn't know we had. It can work as a relationship filter. I certainly seen this in my life as some of my family members are closer to me and some are now further away. And so it's really reorganized my family relationships. And some of my brothers I'm close to that I wasn't close to before, and some that I was closest to I have no relationship with anymore. So this can be a benefit. Meaning through storytelling, this is something that they actually have a lot of therapy now that is about getting people to write or tell their stories. Narrative identity, our internalized story or personal myth. One source of meaning is coherence. So we need to feel like all these different parts of our lives fit into a single story if we can, and that's correlated with mental health. Narrative creates a whole for our lives to be coherent, need to make sense of the world, and it's fundamental to the human search for meaning. And I think this is kind of interesting. Mental health may be an inability to tell a good story of one's life. So maybe we just got to work on that story more if we're still having poor mental health, and that's what a lot of the therapy is about. Rewrite the story in a more positive way. One example was an older man who, this is Viktor Frankl, told this story about this man whose wife had died, and he was very depressed and just having a hard time getting motivated to live. And Viktor Frankl said, "No, I want you to think about a situation. Think about what it would have been like for your wife if you had died first and she was the one sitting in this chair." And got emotional, and he's like, whoa, and he realized she couldn't have handled it. She would have been worse off than he was, and then he had meaning because he realized his living made it so that she didn't have to suffer, and he didn't need any more therapy after that. The fourth one, and this is going to be tough for us hardcore materialist atheist people, transcendence, expansion of the self. And we don't want to talk about spirituality sometimes as atheists, but this is an important part of meaning in our lives, and I'm going to try to make an argument for this here. So mystic experience is one area that you hear a lot about, and it's kind of an off button for the self. So we talked about the self. There's two areas of the brains that they know from studies. They study these meditating monks, and when they feel this separation from their body or this transcendent experience, then they go in and scan their brains, give them a dye, and they see what has gone into different parts of the brain. And they find that there's two areas of the brain that are actually limited, that are not getting the blood and not being active. One is the frontal lobe that handles our language and decisions and judging about the world. And the other's in the back is the orientation place where we know where my body ends and where other things start. And so those two areas, if you don't have that, the body still tries to find its boundary, but it no longer has the skin, the body, and so we start to identify with the universe or with the life around me the plants, the animals. I'm part of it all, and it creates this peace. And William James says there's four qualities of a mystical experience. Passive, so it's happening to me. It's transient. It's changing. It's indescribable. It's not my logic part of my brain and language. It's the right side of the brain that is experiencing it. And it imparts knowledge. It's like I'm taken on a tour. It's the near-death experience kind of thing. It fits in this category. There's a lot of psychology literature on awe. So when something new and unprecedented occurs, it's transformative. You feel this awe. So I kind of think of it as the right braining, taking control and giving my left brain a view of its perspectives, because the left brain's always in charge. It's the one that's doing the talking and the thinking. But there's a lot in our right brain that knows that our left brain doesn't know we know. And so I feel like I'm allowing myself to be exposed to that through this experience. So secular spirituality, that's kind of a contradiction of terms. There's a lot of negatives that can be associated with religion, but not with spirituality. Religions are dogmatic. They create righteous people. They are based on beliefs. They're institutional, so Jehovah's Witnesses have a different set of beliefs than Mormons. Theological, scriptural, none of those things are part of spirituality. So spirituality is really a different animal. It's not the same as, I don't want to take the time to go through all of this. Let me see if there's something. So down here at the bottom it says spirit. Descartes was the first modern famous philosopher, and he believed that the spirit, the thinking thing, the thinking essence within us has an immaterial substance. And the Doctrine and Covenants talks about a fine, pure material substance. And I thought it was interesting to see that some of these advocates for atheist spirituality talk about the spirit as an openness of finite beings to infinity, of inferior beings, that means we're limited in time, just a very short moment in time, to eternity, relative beings to the absolute. So there's a way in which we have, through our consciousness, an ability to think about infinity and to imagine eternity and absolute, and even though we're very limited in who we are, and that's what he called the spirit. So this is three people that are advocates. Robert Solomon is the one that I like the best, but this French philosopher in the middle is very, very good. They talk about, I just compared I think Solomon talks about spirituality as a thoughtful love of life. He studies emotions. Comte Sponville is the one that talked about the spirit as an openness. So I've got to give you the final answer before I'm going to turn it back to Ernie. But this is the final one. So the answer to the meaning, what is the meaning of life? And I really like this quote by Jonathan Haidt. He says, life is much like a movie we walk into well after the opening scene, and we will have to step out long before the story ends and reaches its conclusions. We're trying to figure out, what is this all about? What's going on here? And I missed the beginning, and I probably can't stay the end, but I'd really like to know what this is. That's kind of what we're asking when we ask, what is the meaning of life? We're not asking, what is the meaning of a table? We're using that word in a different way. And so the real question is, what is something enlightening about life? There's two subparts, sub-questions. One says, what is the purpose of life? Why am I here? And you could say, well, God put me here, if you're religious. If you're a scientist, you can say evolution is why I'm here, but that's not very satisfying either, because how did the Big Bang start? You know, there's questions why It just, why is not a very good question to answer. You can't really give a good answer to why. But you can answer, what is the purpose within life? How should I live? This is what we're asking when we say, what is the meaning of life? Is how should I live? What is something enlightening about life? And we can answer that. And this is where I've told you the four themes. People need love, work, a connection to something bigger. If you get these right, a sense of purpose and meaning will emerge. So that's the answer. And I'll turn it back to Ernie.
He's pretty amazing, isn't he? All right. Well, we've covered a lot. I mean, meaning, how does that play out in your life? And the interesting thing is, I think, the challenge is subjective. And what that means is, well, you make the decisions. You determine how the insights play out in your life. So I'm going to wind up and share with you some photos and hopefully give you some insights how I'm finding and creating meaning in life. And thanks to Gary, I am not at all techno-savvy. I was able to put this together. Now, it doesn't surprise me, though, that the leading source for meaning, one that overlaps with happiness, is relationships with others. Bondings, connections, community. But I need to emphasize something, I believe, that the qualifier is healthy relationships, healthy connections. And you know what? Research is showing that as we age, these types of bonds are critical for health outcomes, for well-being. Bonds like these. So this at the core of my life is where I start when it comes to meaning. These are people that, as Gary in a way puts, in a response to me, make me worthwhile. Now, interestingly, though, for one of the most difficult things I've observed where people lose one's faith is the loss of close friendships, community, but probably the worst one is when it's the loss of family ties. And we've experienced that in Gary's family. Where can transitioned Mormons go? Do you remember Elder Ballard's attempted scary query? Where will you go? This is where you can go. I personally believe that the beauty here is that this is the Open Stories Foundations, the Mama Dragons, Women of a Certain Age, Men of a Certain Age, Sunstone. I believe that these sources can provide an accelerated means of rebuilding lost community, friends, connections. In fact, that is what has been happening to Gary and me. 2 years ago, we didn't know any of these people, with the exception of Harold and Leslie. And these are just a smidgen of the amazing people that we have met in the transitioning and transition community. And it's incredible. You have to meet this family sometime. That's Paul and Lisa Hacking, and you get an example of what we're talking about, where instead of obedience being the first law of heaven, it's love. So anyway, but now Gary talked about purpose, and I think that's a loaded one because you've got to answer that yourself, not just once, but throughout your life. And I recall that when I worked, I actually did find purpose in life when the results were saving somebody's job, avoiding a strike. And on rare occasions, helping employees deal with a death at work due to an accident or some violence. So anyway, and before I show you this slide, I thought that I want to tell you that I think a point first needs to be emphasized. Ever since I left Mormonism, I avoid being a purist at anything. I believe one of the subtle esteem crushers is trying to be perfect. A standard of perfection, I think, almost always assures falling short and thereby feeling less. Steinbeck put it best. He said, "And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good." Here are some of the activities, though I realize they may seem insignificant, but they're personal to me, that bring me purpose in the scheme of the universe. Since I believe life is finite, Gary and I, we try to stay fit. In the center there is a van that belongs to Harold, my friend. We both worked on the Encircle House and helped put in the tile, so service to others. And there's a picture in the center with Harold and Leslie and our grandson and Gary and I when we were cleaning up. I think the ones on the bottom are self-explanatory, our mothers. And I tell you, Gary's an excellent example, but every Wednesday we go down and we spend almost half a day with his mother, and we take her to the beauty parlor and we get her out because she's now in hospice care. And then also it includes standing up for things we believe. That's where you see us protesting after Prop 8, protect my marriage. Marriage is a civil right. And a first for me, I've never planted a flower in my life till about 3 months ago. That's me watering the garden. And then on the very far right, you see some of the projects that give me purpose. I mean, look at that fence. Who would have known that somebody like me could even do that? So anyway, but finally, I think it may become obvious to you that the things Gary talked about, they overlap. But it took me some mental wrestling for me to grasp what Esfahani Smith was getting at when she stressed the significance of telling our stories, of narrative, sense-making. And it wasn't until it struck me that, well, this is our personal means of making sense of ourselves, because it answers the question, who are you? Who am I? And so I realize part of it is telling our stories, like we're telling our stories here today. This to the left is the EXMO conference. In the center, 6 months ago, over the internet, through Facebook, I met a cousin. She's about 6 months older than me. We've never met. And now we're sharing the stories of our lives with each other. This right here, a stack of books, are the kinds of things that keep me going. You'll see that the bottom book is the foundation for me. It says philosophy. But anyway. And then this right here, I realize I just, you know, one of these every now and then on Facebook, it says, you ought to take this test and see what you're made of, right? And I did. It was a personality test. And it was revealing to me. It says I'm a complex person. I don't think so, but but it was also meaningful because I think it helped me understand myself, because I have changed over the lifespan. And my anxiety's gone down. And my warmth and friendliness to others has gone up as I realized that I agree that most important in our lives of the identity of self, it really comes from others. So, self-transcendence, what does that mean? I'm not sure words are adequate. Perhaps it's because I'm touching upon the mystery of life, of existence. I think of that strange capacity that each of us have to feel part of something infinitely huge, yet keenly aware of our mortality. So this is kind of a sampling. I tend to be way in my life too extroverted, and so I need to isolate. So I get underwater is a way of removing myself. Of course, I love nature. here I am, foolishly following Gary. He says, this is a paved path, this is easy. Well, that's Angel's Landing, and that's a 3,000-foot drop. And, of course, the idea of looking at the night sky and feeling. And I love John Lennon's, imagine if all of us were living life in peace. So anyway, I'm really happy we got to do this. It honed my own awareness and gratitude that despite having suffered the death of belief, my life is filled with meaning. So yes, there is a life worth living beyond Mormonism. Thanks.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He's an atheist and I'm an agnostic, and it seems to me he's a lot more dogmatic than I am.
Yeah.
But is there some way to avoid that?
Well, maybe he needs to watch this presentation. I can give you a couple good books for him.
Along with that, do you ever have to catch yourself feeling that in your atheism that's become your God? Do you ever look at atheism like you looked at religion at one time? Like if you're not really thinking that someone asked you a question,
give me the answer.
Yeah.
Hit with that, like, I don't know if I
made. Not too long ago, about a year ago, we attended a debate of where two BYU professors and some others, including the president of the American Atheist Society. And the question was, what is the biggest misunderstanding about you, Mormons? And I forget what the answer was, and you, the atheists. And he said, well, for the atheists, that we are mean. And I tell you that I even being in Utah, I always use the word secular because I think the word atheist has been demeaned and is loaded as meaning anti-God, anti-religion, and there are some people that are angry atheists. So, but to address that, yeah, I've avoided going there because I don't feel that way. I have an attitude that while I may not believe, if a belief gives a purpose and a sense of life to someone and values that are good, I'm all for it. The line I draw is that when we insist our dogma should become part of the law or should be required of everyone.
I think the Mormon in that panel said that the most misunderstood part of Mormonism is that we're the most inclusive of all religions. And the audience kind of laughed at that. I thought that was funny. But I think there are some really beautiful, spiritual, wonderful atheists and you're just amazing people. But you're going to find black and white people on both sides of this religion, atheism, and there's just as bad Mormons, just as bad atheists. They want to smash the other side. They don't care if they hurt other people and try to tear them down. I don't think that's good mental health. I think he's going to be a miserable old man, and what has he got to gain from it? You know, he's going to die, and it's all going to be over, and he doesn't believe in anything, so why not start living life and bonding with people instead of, I think there's a lot to be gained from a deeper understanding. And most academics, the higher you go, the less dogmatic they become. They actually start to realize life is very complex. Anyone else? Yes, one more.
I think, as with most people, it's a journey, so you don't say, hey, here I was. But mine started before I knew Gary. I was in a relationship, Actually, Mark was here earlier, but he said he had to leave, so he had another obligation. But he was called in he was in Long Beach. He was in the choir for 3 years, and the bishop loved his voice, was running interference from anybody that said, hey, what's that guy doing singing, until he got a call from Lawrence C. Dunn and said, you know, you need to call this guy into a court. And with my background, I said, well, you know, you have a right of representation. I'm going to be there. And they said, well, who are you? He said, oh, we need you to be part of this court. But I want to tell you that ironically, and I think it was rare, it was not a negative experience, because I think we went very open-minded, understanding that he basically had an obligation to do what they had to do. But we went with the intent of educating. And what happened was, at the end, three men ran out. One of them was just like Boyd K. Packer, you know, this is wrong, boom. And the rest not only stayed and shook her hands, and over half of them were in tears. And struck me as kind of strange, but the stake president said, you could tell he was frustrated. He said, you're the very kind of men we need on high councils and in stake presidencies, and here we're throwing you out. So
I think Ernie didn't complete his journey until after he met me, because I pushed the envelope, kind of forced him to challenge some of the ideas that he hadn't fully thought through yet. I got some little inspiration and finally accepted that I was gay about 30, and then I decided to take 3 years off and study at BYU to figure out what relationships are like and what I wanted to do with my life. And I think it was in that three-year period of studying and researching, being involved in the gay community, that I lost my beliefs. But then Ernie started studying Richard Dawkins after we got together. So we've been hopscotching a little. It's fun to share a life with somebody that's on a similar journey. I guess we're out of time. Thanks, everybody, for coming.